But first, in his State of the State address last month, Governor Snyder was crystal clear. Michigan's roads are creaky and old, and they need to be fixed. Just about everyone agrees with that. The big question is how to pay for those badly needed repairs. The governor wants $1.2 billion every year for those road repairs, so he's proposed raising our gas tax and vehicle registration fees. That proposal isn't getting a lot of love, especially among Republicans who aren't fans of much of anything that looks, smells, or sounds like a tax increase. So there are other ideas afoot in Lansing. Let's find out more now as we welcome the Capitol correspondent at Crain's Detroit Business, Chris Gouts. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
And we welcome the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News, Chad Livengood. Hello, Chad.
Hi, thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Good to have you with us. Chris, I'm going to start with you. The governor first proposed additional funding in the form of that gas tax increase and the registration fees when he first took office, and that withered on the vine. What do you think made him think proposing these ideas again would work this time?
Well, I think he's just trying again. We talked with him today, and he said, you know, the point is that even though there seems to be some, you know, reluctance to his ideas in terms of raising the gas tax, and now there's all these other ideas of how to fund the roads. He says the great thing is that there's actually ideas being discussed, and we're not ignoring the problem. So he's going to keep, proposing his plan, which is more of a user fee based system. But he's open to hearing these other ideas as long as the end result is we get around $1.2 billion for roads, which he says is badly needed.
So, Chad, what are some of the ideas that are being floated besides this user fee based system?
Well, the latest idea that's kind of emerged is expanding the sales tax base to include services such as lawn mowing or hair cutting. And the other idea that goes along with that is going to the voters and asking for an increase in the sales tax with the idea of maybe repealing the sales tax on gasoline. That's one of the rubs about gas taxes in Michigan is that we charge a 6% sales tax on every dollar of gasoline. And right now, if you're buying $4 gas, you're paying 24 cents in sales tax on top of 15 cents on diesel or 19 cents a gallon on unleaded gasoline.
Ouch.
And that makes Michigan's overall tax, state taxes on gas, one of the top five in the country, higher than all the neighboring states. And what really irks a lot of voters and motorists is that those 24 cents sales tax that they're paying on $4 gas, hardly any of that is going to roads. It's mostly going to schools, and then some of it goes to municipalities, which sometimes does tend to flow back into local street repairs, but not the way people think that all the gasoline tax they pay is actually going to fix the roads that they tear up.
Well, now let's talk about this service tax, the sales tax on services, because take us back a little. Blink and you missed it. Back in 2007, it emerged with great backlash and quickly repealed. Remind us why all of that happened, because it was kind of a PR disaster, wasn't it?
Yeah, in the middle of the night on October 1st of 2007, our state government was temporarily shut down for a few hours. And to stop that government shutdown, they passed this sales tax on services that hit a lot of strange services that the people hadn't even thought that even knew existed. I mean, baby shoe bronzing and balloonograms and telegrams and escort services.
Tanning salons, I think, were included.
But lawyers and accountants and other people who have voices inside the Capitol Dome, they all got exempted, and it got widely derided, and it never even got implemented. They repealed it almost two months later, and so now the talk is, well, this time it'll be different. You know, this time it'll actually be hitting the entire service industry. If that's the case, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out here, because you start buying high dollar items, and the installation costs starts to get a service tax on top of it. You're talking about appliances and furnaces. This could really jack up the price on a lot of services that people utilize.
Chris, who's pushing for this now?
Well, I don't know that it's I think it's probably being pushed by those who see that the tax man is coming for them, and they would rather see it put on someone else. And so, you know, this idea of the service tax, I think it's just I don't really see it going anywhere. I mean, I think the likelihood that they would actually do a service tax is about as likely as I would be to get my children's baby shoes bronze. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And yesterday, I knew I was going to be on the radio, so of course I went out and got my hair cut because I wanted to look good for the show, and I wanted to ask my barber what he thought of the service tax. And before he could even sit down in the chair, he said, you know, they're trying that service tax thing again. And it's just, you know, these small business owners, they just don't get why, you know, the government keeps coming after them. And, you know, it's incredibly, in a business like that, I mean, how do you... He said he would just eat the cost, because instead of trying to attach a service, you know, a sales tax to each, you know, haircut, he would just have to figure out and hire a bean counter to figure out at the end of the month or the end of the quarter, you know, how much he's going to, you know, have to send to the state. And it's just a giant mess, and it's just more paperwork. And it's just, I really don't see this happening. The only way that it could is that you can make the argument that this is not increasing the tax, it's expanding the base. You know, that's how, I mean, there are still Republicans in Lansing that will say with a straight face that they didn't raise the pension tax. There was already a pension tax, and they just eliminated all the exemptions and just made it for, you know, a pension tax for everyone. So, you know, if it came down to it and they just couldn't find a way to fund the roads through increasing the you know, the gas tax or registration fees, maybe they could do that. But I just really find it hard to believe that that's the route they would go.
I'm speaking with Chris Gouts, who's capital correspondent at Crain's Detroit Business, and Chad Livengood, who's the Lansing reporter for the Detroit News. There's a group of lawmakers out there now, guys, who are saying, hey, when not so fast, do we even need revenue increases for roads? Couldn't we find the money somewhere in the budget? Is this a pretty powerful group in their negotiations, Chad?
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of people out there that still think that there's a lot of money still to be had elsewhere. By all accounts, the Michigan Department of Transportation is a much smaller organization than it was 5-10 years ago. There's a lot of efficiencies been wrung out of that. This legislature a couple years ago passed a law allowing counties to essentially consolidate their road commissions and get rid of what always has been sort of a plum job, a road commissioner, and just make that a department within the county government and subject to a county executive or a county commission's supervision. So that has wrung out some efficiencies in the county system, and so there's not a lot of places to go unless you want to start taking into general fund. I mean, right now, this year, just to keep up with federal matching funds, more than $100 million from the general fund for the first time in any recent memory had to be spent on MDOT just to get the full federal match because the gasoline tax is not keeping up and has continued. It's been on a decline for at least 5 or 6 years, and if not more, and that's mostly because consumption is down. People are driving more fuel-efficient vehicles. They're not driving as much because of the economy, and so we are. That's what they're trying to get at in this whole talk about changing the way we tax gas, so that it can actually increase over time with inflation and with use.
Chris, you've noted tax increases of any kind probably would lose support from the most conservative Republicans and also the most vulnerable Democrats concerned about their next election. So how likely do you think a deal will get done this legislative session?
You know, even though it seems so, you know, incredibly tough to get something, I do somehow, and I can't explain why, but I do think that there will be something done this year. It just seems like people are thinking, at least in the right way, that there is a problem. It's a $1 billion plus problem, and they want to get it done, which are, you know, three things that were not said even as much as a few months ago in the last session. So things seem to be pointing in the right direction, but like you said, it's incredibly tough that there's electoral considerations. You know, when they passed the last gas tax increase in 97, they did it right before the 4th of July weekend, and they kept the lawmakers locked in the Capitol until about 5 in the morning. And there was some talk a week or so ago with Senate Majority Leader Randy Ridgeview, who said that he thinks that a deal will get done by 4th of July. And I don't think he was just sort of being optimistic. I think he understands the political ramifications that if we're going to do this, you have to get it done by then. Because if you let the lawmakers go home for the summer and they hear more and more from their constituents, You know, it just makes it all more tougher. Plus, when you come back, then you start getting into the race for governor and individual Senate races and House races. So if it's going to get done, it's got to get done really fast.
So then they can go home 4th of July and get an earful from everybody who is paying like well over $4 a gallon for gas.
The other thing I think you're going to see, Cynthia, is if they get it done by the 4th of July or mid-June and they get a new revenue stream coming into state government this summer, then next this fall they can actually put it, order up a couple more paving jobs in September and some other road construction. I think you're going to see a big publicity push. Other states that I've actually worked in like Missouri and Delaware, they put up signs along the highway. As promised, we've paved this road. I would not be surprised if Governor Snyder, a guy who likes to tout results and show results, does some similar type of campaign to essentially, you know, tell the people that you're getting something for the additional pain at the pump.
Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crain's Detroit Business, and Chad Livengood, Lansing Reporter for the Detroit News. Great talking with you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan's lawmakers have a decision to make. Do they choose to keep the drunk driving threshold at 0.08, where it's been since 2003, or do they do nothing and in doing so allow it to bounce back up to 0.10? Let's talk about this now as we're joined by the chairman of the Traffic Safety Committee of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, Jim Carmody, who joins us now from Wyoming. Hi, Jim.
How are you?
Good to have you with us. What is the position of your group on this, Jim?
Our position right now is we support the two current bills that have been proposed that are going to maintain the blood alcohol level at 0.08 into perpetuity.
You want to see that locked in?
Yes.
Why was the switch made in 2003 from 0.10 to 0.08? And even more, why does it revert back to 0.10 if there's not any action taken?
Well, this actually started back in 1998, some legislation started at the federal level. Encouraging states to start taking as a incentive to change the blood alcohol down to 0.08. And then in 2000, Congress passed a bill that further incentivized that by tacking a 2% decrease in highway funds for those states that did not pass the 0.08 laws.
So there's some financial incentive to the states to stick with that 0.08.
That's correct.
Well, it is interesting. I was looking online and, you know, reader comments when articles come up about this are kind of interesting. And there are folks out there who shot in some criticism of that 0.08 and talking about it's a way to generate income for communities and that 0.08 is just too severe. So what do you say to that?
Well, especially in the state of Michigan, what people don't understand is that money does not come back to the communities per se. The fines and fees that are charged against that really go to the state. Some of those fundings come back to the courts, to the individual courts, and those are or Secretary of State. So we really, as a community, we realize very little, if any, financial increase from these types of laws.
You talked about the, I guess, if you will, just the mindset that has grown over the years about not drinking and driving. I'm noticing the new billboards in this area that says you just blew $10,000 and about buzzed drinking and driving. What more needs to be done? What needs to happen to really stamp this out? Because it is stunning to think that it still happens. You still read about the accidents where somebody's going the wrong way on a freeway, and I'm sure you have a lot of stories yourself through your career about this.
Well, and I think we're doing that. We've reduced drunk driving deaths significantly over the past 20 years. Back when you look back in the 1980s, drunk driving or alcohol-related deaths were somewhere in the range between 40 and 50,000 a year. If there was anything that society did, and you hear people criticize or complain about the loss of life in wartime activities, when we can sit back and look at 40 to 50,000 lives lost every year just in alcohol-related crashes, and people kind of turn a blind eye to that, that tells me something that we've got a problem that needs to be fixed. That number's been reduced now to about somewhere in the range of about 18,000. So there are now today, on average, every year, 30,000 people walking around who may not have been walking around 20 years ago as a result of an aggressive campaign, both educational and enforcement.
Jim Crabbity, tell us about, you say there's two bills that are in the works. What are you hearing from legislators, and what kind of timetable are you looking at, or what are you hearing from them?
I appeared a couple of weeks ago before the committee, Criminal Justice Committee, on those two bills. Both bills are one's a parallel bill that maintains the blood alcohol at 0.08. Some of the feedback I've got from other legislators that they are supportive of it. They do understand the importance of it. And again, you know, some people want to try to define this by how many drinks can I have between a 0.08 and a 0.10. And my question and the question that I posed when I appeared before the committee was, how many lives are worth those couple of drinks?
Yeah, yeah. What kind of timetable needs to happen? Now, this would revert in October, correct?
In October of this year, yes.
All right. So you're kind of in a little bit of a limbo waiting to hear what may happen after that testimony in the committee.
And that's correct. And I think a lot of people, including some people in law enforcement, were surprised that there was a sunset clause in this bill that would revert it back to 0.10. When you look at it, and you know, people took, you know, the question came repeatedly, why 0.08? And there are over 300 different studies right now that have been done over the past 20 years that all have come to the same conclusion, that no matter who you are, what's your size, your metabolism, your age, that there's significant reduction in abilities at 0.08 when it comes to certain functions that are very important when you're driving your car. And that's depth perception, that's multitasking, those sorts of things. We see that today with people texting, with using cell phones. It's that moment, that lost moment when you hesitate or you are distracted that can make the difference. When you look at some of the other laws around the world, in numerous countries, that alcohol level is a 0.04, 0.05 range.
Yeah, so, I've seen that.
I think everybody's seeing the same thing.
And that sunset clause, as you say, you wonder where in the world that came from.
That's a question I can't answer, but you know, it was legislated, so I think it speaks for itself.
There you go.
So I won't go any further than that. So.
We've been talking with the chairman of the Traffic Safety Committee of the Michigan Association of Chiefs of Police, Jim Carmody, joining us from Wyoming in Southwest Michigan. Jim, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to the challenge of food insecurity, a fact of life for some 50 million Americans. Researchers at the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment are taking part in a major study to probe the causes and solutions to food insecurity in Michigan. In short, how do you link up the people who are not getting enough fresh, healthy food with the producers and the sources of that safe, healthy food? University of Michigan Professor Dorsita Taylor is one of the lead investigators. She's a professor of environmental justice at the School of Natural Resources and Environment at U of M, and she's kind enough to join us in the studio. Welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor, just to get us on the same page, how do you characterize food insecurity?
Food insecurity, we can think of it in several ways. It could be lack of having any supermarkets or grocery stores in your neighborhood. So it could be physical access. It could be the distance you have to travel to the store. So if it's more than a mile, people tend to think of that as beyond the distance that a person could easily walk to or bicycle to. It could also be financial access. So if you don't have the money to purchase food, if it's too expensive, then that could be a problem. It could also be cultural. If you can't get the foods that you like or you desire, it could be psychological. You might have everything, but you don't know how to cook it, or you're afraid to try a new product or a new type of food. So when we think of food insecurity, we can think of it in those several ways, or access to food. We can also think of it in terms of you might not have enough at home. Mm-hmm. So you might have to skip a meal, or you might have to withhold food from certain members of the family to
what
make
we might,
food stretch.
What we might think of as a traditional view of the hunger problem.
Yeah, the hunger problem. So it's not starvation. In the U.S., starvation is not as huge a problem as it is in the developing countries. But lack of enough food is. And so we find many families, for instance, children going to school without a breakfast, hence the school lunch program. So there are a number of dimensions to food security that we think about as we approach this study.
So we may be looking very, very much, in your study, you may be focusing on, as you say, people who literally do not have mm-hmm. enough food to get through the day.
Yes.
Who may have to turn to a soup kitchen or a food bank. Mm-hmm. But you're also looking at people mm-hmm. who have access, but it's what they're able to access is
yes.
the problem.
Right, yes.
How widespread is this problem in Michigan, Professor?
In Michigan, it's becoming a larger and larger problem. Say about 59% of Michigan's population live in areas where they do not have access to food outlets that are selling healthy foods.
That is mind-boggling.
It is in a state in which we grow so much food, in which, you know, farming is big. It makes very little sense that we have this problem.
So are we looking mm-hmm. at urban more than rural?
Rural. In our study, we will be looking at 18 small to medium-sized cities. And three of those cities are in the Upper Peninsula. We're looking at those cities because they have large Native American communities. And this is a community that's really not been studied very much in terms of access to foods. Then we're looking at some small cities on the western part of the state, in the middle of the state, and in the southeast. Even though we are focusing on cities, we are looking at the whole state per se. So we're collecting data that we can compare these cities with what's going on with rural areas. So we don't want rural Michigan to fall into the cracks.
And I'm sure that the mm-hmm. lessons learned in as the study progresses will be yeah. able to be applied throughout the entire
state. And even beyond, because we'd like our model to be a model that could be used in other states. Very few of these studies look at it statewide. And that was one of the things the USDA liked about what we proposed, to do this broader study, look at Arab Americans, African Americans, Native Americans, Hispanics, Asians, whites. Mm-hmm. So look at kind of a more comprehensive view of it. And so we're hoping that we can have some lessons for the rest of the country from what we find.
If you're just joining us, mm-hmm. this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, speaking today with University of Michigan Professor Dorsita Taylor. She's one of the lead investigators in a big study that's being done across the state of Michigan by many, many schools. Mm-hmm. University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment is a part of this. She is a professor of environmental justice at the School of Natural Resources and Environment, and looking into the challenges of food insecurity, which when you say to me 59% of Michiganders live in areas with limited access to grocery stores that are selling healthy, affordable food. So where are they going?
Where are people going? If they don't have a full-line grocery store mm-hmm. selling fresh fruits, vegetables, meat, they tend to get their food from gas stations, pharmacies, drug stores, gas stations.
Party stores,
liquor stores. And that's a bit troubling because those food outlets tend to have very few fruits and vegetables in their supply, very little fresh milk. They tend to sell highly processed food, very fatty. And those foods tend to be more expensive than if you buy them at a place like a Kroger, an A&P, Meyer, mm-hmm. something mm-hmm. like that.
And then the result as far as health?
Yeah. Linked to health, then, there are studies from national sources, CDC, for instance, mm-hmm. that link the consumption of overly processed food, especially a lot of consumption of that, low vegetable intake, with things like hypertension, definitely weight gain, and other kinds of illnesses. And it's particularly concerning with children that they do have access to mm-hmm. fresh fruits, vegetables. They're supposed to have 5 servings a day.
No. And I know there's a mm-hmm. huge national conversation about the potential for diabetes
mm-hmm. yes.
in our kids today and their lifespan mm-hmm. because of this. So
because of the lack of access to food. And so this link is being made more and more. And so we want to at least see why are the stores not carrying mm-hmm. the healthy foods, and how can this be enhanced, that there's a better connection between the growers and the retailers to have more of this food supply in their stores.
So, Professor Taylor, what are your thoughts as you look at the policies as they exist today that you might want to see in a perfect world corrected, or added to?
I know, for instance, some urban farmers are a bit frustrated with some of the state and city policies. For instance, it's illegal in many parts of the state to have a hoop house. Or the whole issue of farm animals in cities, you know, things like having chickens, goats, that sort of stuff. And I know Michigan, both farmers, consumers, and policymakers are working to see how they can bridge the gap between what are really kind of antiquated rules that go back quite a ways in our history that really kind of moved farms outside cities.
Mm-hmm.
And now that you have cities like Detroit that has space, Flint, and you do have people interested in growing their own foods, you know, what are so? How are the ways can we facilitate that? In some cases, it's just lack of water. So you might have an open space that you can grow something on, but you don't have a water mechanism to get to it. So what are the ways policies can be changed to make it easier for people to enter into the food production
and
system?
It strikes me as you spell out some ideas here, and I know it's kind of brainstorming, but it doesn't strike me that these are necessarily expensive, costly things, because we know that the piggy bank is pretty empty when it comes to spending money on these things.
And you know, it's the sort of stuff where especially food activists are willing to try very innovative things to get their farms running. And many of these farmers are the ones that can get food to urban areas, and particularly relatively inexpensive. So it seems like we should be looking at how can we all work together to change this problem.
Professor Taylor, what do you hope will be the outcome of this 5-year study? There's going to be a lot of work done by colleges and universities all over Michigan.
Yes.
And your part of it is University of Michigan School of Natural Resources Environment. Your hopes 5 years down the road?
5 years down the road, we hope to see a kind of measurable reduction in food insecurity, both from our studies getting back to communities, because once we conduct these interviews, we will, for instance, get back to the food retailers. Here's what the farmers are saying. Mm-hmm. Here's what your consumers are, your customers are saying. And so to start a better dialogue between the key stakeholders in this, we will have several courses that will be taught across these campuses, some more collaboration. Across the state, probably a better understanding of food insecurity in Michigan. Where are the hot pockets of lack of access? Where are people doing better? What models? We're getting some interesting ideas from some of our community garden. So it's really exciting. There are going to be a lot of really interesting things coming out of this.
And if you live in towns like Holland or Muskegon or Grand Rapids or Dearborn Heights or so many of these others that are involved in the study, and somebody comes up to you and wants to talk to you about what you bought at the grocery store, be a part of it, because you could really be changing the base of knowledge on food in Michigan. Professor, thank you so much. And I know we'll be checking in through the course of this, and it'll be very interesting as you start getting results from the field and in your food study and learning even more.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
University of Michigan Professor Dorceta Taylor, she's one of the lead investigators in a major new 5-year, $4 million study of disparities in access to healthy food all across Michigan. She, of course, is with the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder has appointed a new justice to the state Supreme Court. The appointment comes after former Justice Diane Hathaway formally resigned last month amidst a scandal over a personal real estate deal and pleading guilty to bank fraud. And for many court watchers, it was a surprise pick. Chief Judge of the Macomb County Circuit Court, David Viviano, is the governor's choice. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now. Rick, you were at the announcement. What can you tell us about Judge Viviano?
Well, as you pointed out, he was something of a dark horse appointment. That his name was on a lot of people's lists, but typically you'd see someone pulled from the Court of Appeals, among other things. It would give the governor an appointment to that court as well to do that. And my understanding of what really intrigued Rick Snyder about Judge David Viviano is that he found him to be, I think, maybe something of a kindred spirit, forward-looking, technology-minded, that he's considered a very, very able chief executive of the circuit court. He's participated in a lot of pilot projects dealing with things like new jury rules, electronic filing, things like that. And so it seems like this is a an appointment of a mind to help, you know, create the Michigan judiciary of the 21st century.
Now, this choice increases the Republican majority on the high court. Do you think we will notice that in court rulings, or will it pretty much be the same since they had the majority anyway?
Well, we don't have a lot of appellate opinions to, you know, to draw from to decide, you know, what he is. But I've checked around on him, and he's considered reliably conservative in the way that, that judges are you know, conservative. He said that he's a, quote, rule of law judge, which, you know, a lot of people would call a strict constructionalist. That, you know, what we'll see is, since, you know, the court already has kind of a lopsided Republican majority, that where the divides are partisan, that now we'll see 5-2 majorities rather than 4-2 majorities, or before Justice Hathaway resigned, 4-3 majorities. So it isn't really expected to change the jurisprudence side of the court a whole lot.
Now, Rick, this appointment does not require confirmation from lawmakers, right? So he can just step right on up.
He will start, I believe, his official first day is Friday, and the courts, the first oral arguments of the new session are this coming Tuesday.
And what are some of the first cases that they'll be taking up with Judge Viviano on the bench?
Kind of a mishmash. Probably the most prominent one is a case of a woman who's suing the Kent County Sheriff's Department. It's a civil action. She said that that she should be able to sue the Sheriff's Department for failing to execute in a timely fashion a pickup warrant for her brother, who was mentally ill and committed suicide in the period between after the warrant was issued. That's probably the biggest case, but it's a mishmash of complicated tax law cases, some criminal law cases, a few insurance cases. And, of course, one of the things waiting for Judge Viviano and the rest of the court to decide on is Governor Rick Snyder's request that they render a special ruling on the legality, the constitutionality of Michigan's new right to work law.
Oh, that's right. That'll be right there on the right there on the front line.
It's now, there sitting on his desk waiting.
Now, and he has to run for re-election in 2014, correct?
Yeah, he just won a 6-year term on the Macomb County Circuit Court, where we should point out his father served as a judge and his sister still serves as a judge. So this is a big Macomb County, you know, legal and political family. And now he will have to run to fill out the term as required by the Michigan Constitution next year, and then he'll have to run again in 2 years because that's when the term expires. So he's going to be one running judge.
Rick Pluta, always good talking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you too.
Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. In less than 2 weeks, on March 10th, the 2013 World Figure Skating Championships begin in London, Ontario. What that means is the eyes of the world will be on a couple of University of Michigan students who have been hailed as one of the greatest American teams in the history of ice dancing. 5-time national champions, silver medalists in the 2010 Vancouver Olympics, 2011 world champions, 4-time Grand Prix final champions. It's no exaggeration to say they have helped to make Southeast Michigan the ice dance capital of America. Merrill Davis and Charlie White are joining me in the studio today, and a pleasure to welcome both of you.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks for having us.
Good to have you here. You know, I have to tell you, as I was watching the Nationals in Omaha, it was an absolutely stunning tribute to what's happening to skating in Michigan. When you look at the top 4 ice dancing pairs, all on the winner's podium, all 4 from suburban Detroit. What's the secret, Charlie, to the astounding success story of Southeast Michigan skaters led by you guys?
Well, I think, you know, we've imported some fantastic Russian coaching to the area, and then, you know, there's just a lot of great kids with good work ethics. And so you know, when you put the two together, you get a lot of success. And it's been a lot of fun for us to be able to celebrate that with our, you know, compatriots from Michigan.
And it's quite amazing just somehow this corner of Southeast Michigan drew these Russian coaches and drew such talent, both of you being homegrown. So you did not come in from elsewhere. But Merrill, I guess as you watch this all happening, when you were starting on the ice as a little five-year-old, who'd have figured, huh?
Yeah, exactly. We're very honored and pleased to be here. It seems to have come so quickly. Mm-hmm.
And now you're training for world championships. You're also juggling classes at Michigan. Describe for us what a typical day is for both of you as far as training, studying, classes, all of the above.
Yeah, so we usually train the first two-thirds of the day, it feels like. We're up pretty early and start on the ice around 7, 8, 9 at the latest. And, you know, we're on the ice for about 4 or 5 hours a day. And, you know, we have a few breaks in there, but we really – you got to leave it all out on the ice every day for practice. And, you know, that's what we try to do. So, you know, 3 days out of the week, we then work out for about an hour and a half. 2 days out of the week, we do ballet. And then we get a chance to go to school. And, you know, it's a great way to actually unwind from the athletic side. And obviously it's more than a distraction. It's something that we love doing. And, you know, there's a reason why even though we put ourselves through so much and athletically, we continue with our education. That's just because we love it so much.
When we're looking at a program that you do, like that 2.5 minutes, how much time, Merrill, goes in to that program? I guess I'm asking, how many times might you have done that before it's really the big moment?
Thousands and thousands. Yeah, we rehearse daily, like Charlie said, for probably about 5 hours a day, 5 days a week. And so by the time we get to a competition like the World Championships, you know, we've been practicing from May until March, usually, of that year. So the time really is important to kind of the perfection that's required for that kind of performance. But I think Charlie and I thoroughly enjoy not only the competition aspect, but the practice aspect as well. We really enjoy kind of seeing our own growth and working really hard. So it's an enjoyable process for us.
How much time now do you see each other off of the ice?
When we're at competitions or, you know, shows, you know, we end up staying together a lot, you know, depending on the situation. And obviously we've been skating together for 15 years, so we've proven that we can put up with one another really well. But, you know, on a day-to-day, like, we don't really hang out after we're done training. I think we just go home and, you know, like I said before, we try to unwind and rest a bit. And so we can come in the next day and be super fresh.
I'm curious, when I was thinking of all the accolades that were pouring down on you and that, you know, you were the big stars as you won your fifth national, is it easy to flip that off and come back and just kind of hang around campus and hang around with your friends and just be those folks again?
For us, it absolutely is. You know, I think it's different for everyone, but Charlie and I have been so fortunate to, as you said, grow up in Michigan, spend our whole lives here, have our families, and kind of the same friends our whole lives. And so when we come home, really nothing has changed. And it is a drastic contrast to come from the U.S. National Championships, where, you know, at this point in our career, we're walking down the hall and most people know who we are. And then we come home, we walk around campus, and more than likely,
nobody
very
with
few
some
people
anonymity.
Know who we are.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, right? Not at all.
We're speaking with Merrill Davis and Charlie White getting ready for the World Championships, the World Figure Skating Championships happening starting March 10th in London, Ontario. And of course, you know, we know you won in 2011 and then did not win in 2012. And we know that Moyer and Virtue are back on, they're on home ice. They're London hometown kids. What is going to happen in your head or is happening in your head to make this a different world than last year?
Well, you know, I think this has been a good year for us competitively. We've had a lot of success so far. We're undefeated. And, you know, in large part, I think that's due to the programs that we have. We feel very confident with the programs and, you know, they've grown so much as the year has gone on. And it's always an interesting thing to compete in, you know, one of the other athletes' home countries. But for us, you know, we have so much experience doing that. Basically, you know, the Olympics were in Canada and that it's not really something we think about. you know, Canada has great skating fans, and there's going to be a great energy in the rink, and so I think we'll be able to use that and just go out there and do our thing.
You know, as you're developing your program, how much input do both of you get into that, or is it more it comes from the coach and this is what you're going to do?
Well, actually, a lot of input does come from our coach. Our main coach, Marina Zueva, is incredibly talented. You know, Charlie and I have been working with her for years, and we're still kind of in awe of her genius. And so I think we like to kind of utilize that to the best of our abilities. But I think now that we've matured and, you know, we're in our 20s, we have a little bit more say than we once did. When we were younger, it was all up to the coaching. But now we like to kind of push the music choices and the choreography in a certain direction.
Do you find that what might win over judges at the national level, is it different when you're going to Worlds? Do you have to change things up, or what do you need to do differently?
Not so much. You know, we try to stay consistent. Obviously, things will adapt through the competitive season, you know, as we feel that some things can be strengthened, some things can be taken out. So it's kind of a nonstop process, you know, and you just want it to be as good as possible. But, you know, as far as international, national judges, there's not a huge difference.
Okay. Got to keep those judges. And it's so subjective, and that's what makes it tough, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Dancing is the same kind of thing where, you know, you think, oh, I did my best, and unfortunately there's no way to actually measure that. After winning that fifth title, I was kind of just looking at articles about you. And, you know, let's be honest, sports writers are like falling over themselves trying to find out new ways to say that you two are the greatest U.S. ice dancers of all time. Now, does talk like that help or hurt your mindset as you're trying to focus in on what's going to happen in London?
You know, we try not to pay too much attention to the media or kind of responses to competitions. I think that we have such a great coaching team and so many wonderful, experienced people around us that we try really to focus on that. Certainly, we read a lot of the articles, you know, the Detroit Free Press articles. But I think that we know where we want to go and how we want to get there. So, you know, catching an article every now and then really doesn't deter us from that vision.
But on the other hand, I would imagine to be a national champion or world champion, don't you need a little bit of swagger and maybe a little bit of we are the best arrogance? Because I'm sure this is no place for a shrinking violet to step up.
No, I mean, it definitely it takes nerves of steel. And I don't think the term swag or swagger is used much in ice dance.
Yes.
But I think we definitely have a lot of confidence. And that comes from years of skating together and performing at the top level and knowing what to expect from one another. And also, you know, our training regimen, we do everything we can to prepare ourselves for that moment. So we don't have to worry when we step out on the ice, like, oh, am I going to be ready for this? We go out there and we can almost relax and sort of let our bodies take over.
You know, I have to say, on behalf of the hockey moms and the skating moms and the Irish dance moms, I was one of those, track and field moms and dance moms, got to say, I love the shout out that you gave on your website to both of your moms, understanding the years of kind of nurturing you, especially since you started when you were so tiny. So here's a question that I bet a lot of moms of competing kids would like to ask. Did they have to twist your arms to get you to practice at any point, or were you kind of always had that little bit, oh, Charlie, you're like...
No, they didn't.
They didn't?
You know, Charlie and I are thorough believers in the idea that if you want it badly enough, you can make it happen, but you have to make it happen yourself. And that's not to say that Charlie and I didn't have an extreme amount of support from our families, but we've both been very driven, hardworking kids since the beginning. And, you know, if anything, our parents made it quite clear that, you know, you don't have to wake up at 5 a.m. You can sleep in. You can go to soccer practice if you want. And this is what we've really always wanted. And our parents have found the perfect balance between encouraging us but not pushing us too much.
And I think that's something a lot of parents are kind of looking for, that key. Mm-hmm. How much do you push? How much do you go back? And then how do you wipe up tears if things don't go well? And I'm sure they had to do that as well. You know, you both started at age 5, and I'm sure as you're at the rink when you're there in Canton and you see the little ones on the rink today who look up to you and hope to be you someday, where do you think your sport will be when they're your age?
Wow, that's a good question. It's probably not something we think about so much. You know, we tend to really just worry about what we're doing in the moment. But I think that the U.S. has a very exciting future in ice dance. You know, it's just been growing exponentially. and you know, just watching the younger couples, even junior novice coming up, we have a lot of talent. And then when you see the juvenile kids who are just insanely talented to be so little, it just almost doesn't even make sense. And it's just so much fun to watch, and just fun to know that we have you know, these great skaters coming up.
And I've got to imagine technically the bar is getting raised more and more every year. When you think of what you're doing today and what's accepted versus, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would suspect you kind of wonder, where's it going to end as far as the technical challenges?
Yeah, there's been quite a drastic change in the last two Olympic cycles, I think, specifically. Mm-hmm. Because of the change in the judging system that happened after the 2002 Olympics, the sport, I think, has taken more of a drastic change and had a lot more growth than possibly in other, you know, another two Olympic cycles. So it's really a very exciting time, I think, to be an ice dancer in particular.
So as you are focusing on what's going to